Football season is here. I'm Steve Brown.
And I'm Thomas Bradley. This is After the Score.
Welcome to After the Score from WOSU Public Media. I'm Steve Brown here with Thomas Bradley. This week, we'll talk to an ultra-marathoner getting ready for a 100-mile race this weekend. My first question, what the heck is he thinking?
And then Steve and I give our thoughts on the NFL's embarrassing suspension of Baltimore Ravens running back Ray Rice.
But first, it may still be the dog days of summer, but football season is upon us. The Ohio State Buckeyes open training camp on Monday. For a preview, we called Ben Axelrod from Bleacher Report. Ben, so Urban started his time at the podium yesterday detailing the status of Braxton Miller. What is Miller's status?
From talking to Braxton, it sounds like he is he's back at full strength, but he actually said that he's not necessarily in game shape yet, that if there were a game to be played this upcoming weekend, he probably wouldn't be playing in it. But he's throwing a football. He started off with a tennis ball, and that lasted for about a day, he said. It sounds like everything's on track with the offseason shoulder surgery, and it sounds like he's where they expect him to be at this point.
Fall camp's coming up soon, so he'll be able to develop that time to get into game shape. What was his attitude? Braxton Miller is normally a quiet guy around the media. Did he shine at all at media days this past week?
He's grown more comfortable with the media, I'd say, in his 4 years here. He's still not, Bradley Roby or any of the guys who seem to really enjoy talking to the media like Jeff Heirman. But I asked him that. I said, do you like this stuff? Do you like talking to us, or is it just something that comes with the territory? And he said, yeah. He goes, it's not that bad. He said, there are a lot of people who would love to be in this position. So I'm honored to be in this position. He's still not the best quote in the world. And I thought it was interesting. I asked Urban Meyer who the heart and soul of the Buckeyes is going to be this upcoming season. And Braxton wasn't really a name he mentioned. The two names that he mentioned were Taylor Decker and Jeff Heirman. Braxton's never really been a rah-rah guy, but he also has some fire. We've seen him go after defenders personally in practice. And we saw last year at Northwestern how Kenny Guyton warming up on the sideline really fired Braxton Miller up. So, Braxton Miller is who he is at this point as a senior. He's not going to turn into Tim Tebow and give these long rants and speeches like that. He just is who he is, and he kind of leads in his own way.
You mentioned Jeff Heirman. I don't think he's a guy that a casual OSU football fan would know a lot about. Talk about him a little bit.
What does Meyer think about him?
Meyer's a guy who's a big Jeff Heirman fan, and that's kind of surprising to Jeff, coming from where Jeff was 2 years ago when Urban first got here. He didn't know where he was going to fit in Meyer's offense. Jeff is from Naples, Florida, and when he was playing down there in high school, he wasn't even recruited by Meyer at Florida. So he had Meyer come in, and Meyer seemed like a coach who favored the big athletic Aaron Hernandez types. And Jeff said to me, he goes, everybody knows I'm not Aaron Hernandez on and off the field. That's kind of to see how far Jeff has come now, and he's probably Ohio State's most reliable returning receiver with Philly Brown gone. And he's just kind of that type A alpha male personality who really kind of clicks with Meyer, just like Jeff Simon did 2 years ago. Like John Simon did 2 years ago. So if they can get any sort of leadership from Jeff like they got from John a few years ago, then the Buckeyes should be in good shape this year.
How many cliches have you heard about Jeff Heirman this week? I'm guessing high motor, character guy, lots of others, right?
I haven't really heard that per se, but I could see where I guess that would come from. Say another cliche, he does kind of do the dirty work. He's more of a blocking tight end, and he's not a guy who's going to bust out a 60-yard catch. He's more of a guy who's going to get in the seams and you know, convert those first downs, kind of like a safety valve, almost like Ben Hartsock did in 2012 for the Buckeyes. But he's going to be an important piece of this offense. And Urban said, you know, we're going to see a lot of two tight end sets, which is not something you think about when you think about spread offenses. But Urban really, really likes what he has in Jeff Heuermann and Nick Vinette, who's a fourth-year junior and a guy who has a lot of experience just like Heuermann does. So this offense might not look like what we've expected it to look like for the past few years.
I don't want to transition off of Aaron Hernandez too much, but let's talk about off-the-field issues a little bit. He Urban Meyer did address the Tracy Sprinkle situation, said he's no longer off the team. Was there a general conversation amongst all Big Ten coaches about off-the-field issues and keeping kids out of trouble?
You know, I don't know if that's something that coaches really, you know, talk about one another, just because I think every coach's policy when it comes to that sort of thing is kind of up to themselves. There's not really a league-wide mandate or league suspensions when it comes to that stuff. But yeah, I mean, there is no Tracy Sprinkle situation anymore from an Ohio State standpoint. He's off the team. He's off the roster. And unless his, you know, legal matter gets resolved in a very, very favorable manner, then he's not going to be back on the team. We saw that 2 years ago with Storm Klein, where his situation actually did get resolved and he was allowed back on the team after being kicked off. And last year, that was kind of the initial take Urban took with Carlos Hyde. But right now, Tracy Sprinkle's not a Buckeye, and for the foreseeable future, he won't be a Buckeye.
We talked a lot about Braxton Miller, Jeff Heuermann. Another focal point yesterday was the OSU defensive line, which at this point looks like one of the most dominant in the country. Michael Bennett, Joey Bosa, Adolphus Washington, Noah Spence. This seems to be the best group on the team right now, right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, this is the Buckeyes' strength, and it's their strength on a defense that really, really needs a strength. You got Michael Bennett, for all intents and purposes, a third-year starter starting inside alongside Adolphus Washington, who's a guy Meyer Penn has singled out yesterday and said we need to play up to the standard that he's capable of, and that's something due to injuries and that he hasn't really done thus far in his career. And then you got Joey Bosa, who is making All-American lists as a sophomore defensive lineman. That's almost unheard of unless your name's Jadeveon Clowney. And then, you know, that Leo spot or that Viper spot, I guess they're calling it now, I don't even know if that's going to exist in Chris Ash's offense, but that's occupied by Noah Spence, and Noah's obviously not going to be playing in the Buckeyes' first two games due to his suspension. But, you know, Tyquan Lewis is a guy who I've heard really, really positive things about, with a redshirt freshman from North Carolina. And so he'll be starting in those first two games, it looks like. So, yeah, the Buckeyes have maybe their most defensive line, you know, dating back to that 2002 team right now.
We're just about 30 days away from the start of the football season. How much excitement and energy did Big Ten Media Days bring toward the start of this year's college football season?
It's just kind of the initial kickoff. It kind of shows you football season's here. We're going to have fall camp starting up here on Monday, and then it's full go. The off season's over, and you know, yeah, Media Day is kind of the first time where you really start to feel that way. So yeah, it's definitely an exciting time. I think this Ohio State team's really intriguing. I think it has the potential to be a national title team. I think it has the potential to be somewhat of a disaster if certain things don't go Ohio State's way. So we'll see. I usually have a pretty good gut feeling on the Buckeyes heading into each season, and this one I really don't yet.
We've been speaking about OSU football with Ben Axelrod. He covers the team for Bleacher Report. Ben, thanks again.
Thank you, guys.
Steve and I have both ran a couple marathons, but never an ultra marathon.
Yeah, 26 miles is long enough for me, plenty long enough. I don't need to do 100 miles.
But at least one Columbus resident is up for the challenge, and Steve and I spoke with PJ Yeagerson, who's running the Burning River 100 in Northeast Ohio this weekend.
PJ, why on earth do you do this? This sounds crazy.
That's probably the second question I get asked the most about
right.
It. There's a certain kind of enjoyment you get out of running ultra distances, and you get an experience that you can't get anywhere else in life other than, you know, almost death, basically.
Is it oddly relaxing at times? Is it do you enter kind of a zone, kind of a meditation place almost?
And a good way to kind of explain that is a lot of my friends that see me out training, they'll try and like yell at me or wave at me, and I don't even notice them. You enter this other world almost in your mind.
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't know by looking at both of us, but Steve and I have both run marathons. Steve has a 3:45 marathon under his belt, and I have just over 4 hours on my best marathon. But everything we're talking about now, you're about to run the Burning River 100. Just multiply that by four. I couldn't even imagine. What do you think about for your –
Thomas is overwhelmed right now.
I'm overwhelmed. I really am. What's your expected finish time for a 100-mile race? What's kind of a goal for you?
A good time is 24 hours, and this is my first 100, so that is the ideal time for me to finish in. That's about a 14-minute mile pace.
Right.
So anyone that's used to running a marathon or a 5K is looking at that time thinking, holy cow, that's really slow. But you are walking, you are jogging, you're doing a lot of different things you wouldn't be doing in a marathon. Plus, you're on a technical trail.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going through mud, you're going through bogs, you're going up and down hills. You're passing, horse traffic on a single path trail. So there's a lot of things that you can't really account for, especially this week. It's been pretty heavy rain, so we're expecting this to be a fairly muddy course potentially too. So
one of the biggest obstacles you would think is a lack of sleep. You're going to be running for 30 hours. That's something people might not think about. You can't sleep, obviously.
Right. And that's actually one you can kind of train for. You can do sleep deprivation training. So you do back-to-back runs on little sleep. So you'll come after a 30-mile run on a Saturday. You'll come home. You only sleep 6-7 hours, get back up, and run again. And it's really not enough time to rebuild everything that you've done to your body and damage-wise. So you're back out there the next day, and you're kind of groggy. You're already sore. You're tired. But that Sunday run then teaches your body that sometimes you have to keep going even though you're still hurt.
We all know training plans for marathons are a big thing where you do shorter runs during the week and a long run on the weekend. But for ultra running, you do two long runs back-to-back on the weekends?
Yeah, so you're basically running 8 hours on Saturday and then another 8 on Sunday.
What will be the longest run you've completed in a single stretch before this 100-mile race? What hour time and how many miles?
Let's see, I think we did a 41.2-mile training run that started somewhere around midnight, and I think we ended about 11 a.m. somewhere in a Starbucks in Clinton. But
you have to be a hit at parties. This has to be something people always want to talk. This is something people always want to talk about, right?
Yeah, they always ask you the same questions, like, why do you run so far?
Right.
Like, I don't even drive that far, and it's just this common joke of these questions you keep getting asked. So.
As Thomas said, he and I have ran a few marathons, and I remember wearing two pairs of socks, putting Band-Aids over some sensitive body parts so they didn't get chafed. That has to just get amplified to the nth degree when you're running 100 miles.
It is, and it's kind of funny because I'm right now in a tapering zone this week, so I'm running down lower miles, and I'm so used to this training routine where I get up and I put all this gear on, I put all this lube and different stuff, different spots, just getting everything prepped. And it takes you maybe 20 minutes just to get ready for a run. Now I'm running 2 miles today for my taper. And it almost feels weird because I'm so used to this routine that I don't even want to get dressed for 2 miles. It takes me longer to get dressed than it does to run it.
You'll just do 2 miles in jeans or whatever. It's fine.
I almost did yesterday. I felt like running in jeans. Friends. So
just exactly. Texting while you're running, tweeting.
Might as well. Just at that point, it's like, why even bother running, right? So,
what about eating? When I ran, I carried power gels with me, especially during marathons.
Oh, yeah.
Those little pudding like protein packs. How do you eat? What do you or drink? What do you? How do you do that?
Personal pan pizzas mostly.
You just have people throw food at you.
Yeah,
you,
there's a really strong craving for food. Almost the entire run, you're basically hungry. So, food discussions are very popular. The aid stations are really well maintained in ultra marathons. They're unlike anything you've ever seen. There's just junk food and all sorts of different carb loaded food pieces there. There's mashed potato bowls, like baked potatoes, pizza, bacon. It's everything junk food-wise you could ever want, plus more. And the thing that's interesting is, the slower you are, you think, oh, I'm never going to get there in time to get the food. And there's just people, the volunteers, just bringing it out all night long for you. So plenty to choose from.
With 100 miles and close to 24-hour running, how many calories is that you're burning? Like, that's got to be close to 12, 13,000 calories?
5 million.
A little under that. Yeah, you hit about on average. So once you've been training this long, your body gets used to it. You burn a lot more fat. The average that I'm looking for around 24 hours is about 9,600 calories burned. So it's not that high compared to what you think. I mean, you burn, say, 2,000 a day in a normal day. On a strong run day for me, might be burning 4 to 5,000 tops throughout the day, but that run will probably take you about 9,000 calories total.
So you could go out and eat 4 or 5 Chipotle burritos after this is all over.
Yeah, and you probably should take one with you on the run too.
How hard is this on your body? You don't want to. I don't know. Are you causing permanent damage by doing this?
You know, that's the other thing. My mom's been hounding me for years about knee damage and all these injuries and just I shouldn't be running so much. And the more you actually study and look at the training history of what causes injury, it's the rest and rehabilitation part that's the biggest thing people miss. They push so hard in the workout, they forget to go back and rest equally as much. So as long as you're taking the right time to rest your body, ice it, you know, elevate your legs and do the right things.
Well, what about your sleep deprivation training? That has to be bad
for
you.
That's tough, but you only do it twice a week. And what you're doing is you're never pushing yourself too far over the maximum. So there's a limit of about 30 miles in a day that I like to, you know, hit set to my body. So I won't run more than 30 miles in a day without getting at least a day or two after of complete rest. So on a Saturday, I might run 30, then I'll run 15 on Sunday. But that's a maximum. Then I have a Monday off with no running at all.
If you don't mind me asking, how old are you?
I'm 30.
So you're relatively young among distance runners.
Yeah, I'm actually probably one of the younger ones.
Huh.
Average age is probably about 35 to 40 at this point.
We're talking to Harvey Lewis later.
No. Oh, sorry. Thought you confused him for Harvey Lewis.
No. We're talking to Harvey Lewis later in the show, and he just competed in the Badwater 135-mile race, and he finished in 23 hours and 52 minutes.
A blazing speed. Just I can't believe what he did through that race in this course. So.
And the course it is, it's in the desert, in the middle of summer, 135 miles, finished it in less than a day. We'll be talking to him later, and we're with P.J. Yeagerson now, who's doing the 100-mile Burning River that goes from Cleveland to Akron through a bunch of trails and a muddy through bogs and down streets. I don't even know where the course goes. It's 100 miles long, but he'll be doing that this weekend. Any advice to someone who wants to start out with running? Obviously, don't start off with a 100-mile race, but there's people out there, and running's becoming more and more popular as we go. Any advice to people out there who want to start and maybe do their first 5K and look at, honestly, people like you and become a little overwhelmed with running?
Yeah, and that's a great question. And I've always had a really strong answer of the color run. That is one of the runs that I'm probably one of the biggest, you know, fans of, really, mm-hmm. for people getting off the couch and getting up and going into a run. There's no time limit. No one's timing you. No one's, you know, watching how fast you go in that kind of a race. It's a race that's all fun. There's excitement. There's music. There's color zones. And a lot of people are just walking it. And it's just the thrill of finishing. So once you've crossed that first finish line, I feel like it gets a bug in most people where they go, you know, I did this. I completed it now. Now I want to go try one for a time. And at that point, you've already met people normally through the race. You've been walking people next to you the entire time mm-hmm. throughout the day. And it's a little bit easier to try and network with someone else that maybe you want to go run with later on or join one of the groups in your community that run.
The Color Run is a 5K.
Yes.
That they throw powdered color at you throughout the race, and there's a party at the end. It's actually my first 5K, so I guess there's some truth to that.
It's really, really popular. I mean, all my friends on Facebook, I'm actually kind of sick of seeing pictures about the Color Run on Facebook at this point.
I bet, and their advertising, you know, marketing is so strong, yeah. and they're really an exceptional run. It's pretty well maintained for a 5K group. I can't think of any other 5K that large across the country that's now nationalized and just known that well, too.
Again, we've been talking with P.J. Yeagerson. He lives in Columbus and is running the Burning River 100 Ultra Marathon in Northeast Ohio this weekend. P.J., thanks for coming in. Thanks for all the information.
Great. Thank you for having me.
As Thomas said, we're joined now by Harvey Lewis, the recent winner of the Badwater 135. Harvey, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you're the best ultra marathoner in the world now, right? That's what this means?
Well, not exactly. I mean, that's a bit of overstatement. There's really some outstanding ultra marathoners around the world, and I guess I'm added to that group.
We talked to PJ a lot about the culture of ultra marathon running and how his life right now, as he's training for this, is just completely consumed by his weekend long runs and his midday runs, and he has almost no time for it. And he's what he called a casual ultra marathon runner, if there is such a thing. What is it for someone who's at the top of their sport like you, who won a 135-mile race? What is your life outside of running right now?
Well, you know, I've become really efficient with multitasking. For example, I live and work in Cincinnati, and I work as a teacher. And this last school year, I ran or biked or walked or kayaked or snowshoed or skied to work every day for the whole school year without using my Jeep. So, you know, that's an example where I was able to incorporate training with my daily commute. And so it really didn't cost me any additional time. But then the other thing is I did, I also really specialize in 24-hour races. I do. We have the national championship is actually in Ohio, which is really exciting, and it's going to be September 20th weekend. And I tend to like go out and run anytime. So I'm not very, you know, some people are regimented where they run every day at 6 a.m. or they run every day at 5 p.m. I might get up and run at 4:30 in the morning, or I might actually go run at 12 midnight. So I run it all over the place. Any time it just happens to be an opportunity.
PJ also joked that the more people are into this ultra marathoning scene, the more they start looking like Jesus or Forrest Gump. And you know, when he was running with the long beard and the long hair. I've seen interviews with you. You have short hair. You look pretty clean cut. But is there something to that? Do you get kind of out there? Are you a little more spiritual? Or how does ultra marathoning change you?
Well, I don't know about that. I think there's a lot of diversity within ultra marathoning, but certainly ultra marathoners tend to be more in tune to nature, so they tend to be more outdoorsy type. They also tend to, you spend a lot of time reflecting on life and you do a lot of philosophizing. You think about the philosophy of life in general. What's that?
I said you only eat granola, and y'all live in a compound in Colorado. And...
Nothing like that at all. No, I mean, not at all. You get really a large variety. I mean, I have P&G friends that run ultra marathons. You know, there's a couple of celebrity ultra marathoners like Anton who have really, you know, just live out in the middle of the Colorado in the mountains and train out there and let their hair grow long. But there's not, you know, really that's just a small percentage. And that's kind of more like a stereotype.
I mean, on a 24-hour race, you're probably going to have at least a 5 o'clock shadow by the end of it because you have no time to shave.
You might have to just shave as you're going.
That's exactly,
you know,
right.
I definitely brush my teeth as I'm going.
Harvey, talk about the conditions of the Badwater 135. It's described as one of the toughest ultra marathons in the world, honestly. Steve and I were talking to PJ. We both have run a couple regular marathons, no ultras by any means. We can't comprehend, I guess, what it means to run 135 miles in the desert. So just give us your thoughts on that.
This race has incredible mountains. The mountains are a combination of the three largest mountains go over 19,000 feet. So that's, you know, nearly over three-fourths of the way up Mount Everest. And it also goes over tremendously hot territory, over 100 degrees in temperature. And you have to deal with winds, really, really fierce winds at times. And you never really know what's going to hit you. You just have to be prepared to adapt. So it's exciting to come from Ohio. A lot of people assume like, well, you must live in a mountainous state, or you must have one of those epoxy tents or something like that. But, you know, training in Ohio, we have such a great community. And you have the Columbus Marathon is coming up in October. That's a fantastic event for the state, one of the best marathons in the world. And, you know, they do an amazing job running it. So just participating in those local events like that, or, you know, now you have the 100-miler that's up in Burning River. That's going to be a great event for people to get involved with. It's exciting.
How do you train for mountains living in Ohio?
Well, in the past, you know, living in Cincinnati, that helps. We've got a lot of hills down here.
That's true.
We invite you guys down to run in them. There's a lot of hills in Cincinnati, so you just go and you pick a hill and you run up and down it about 50 times. So, but this year, I started a business called RunQuest Travel, and I take people on running holidays. So I went over to Portugal, and I trained with my biggest rival, Carlos Saw, who won Badwater last year, and he also was our guide for the RunQuest trip.
You train with
really
him?
Really tremendous.
You train with him? You're like buddies with him?
Yeah, we're buddies.
What's up with that, Harvey?
In fact, he wasn't going to come to Badwater this year, but we had so much time to like do trash talk back and forth that I managed to entice him. He couldn't take it any longer. He said he was going to come.
Well, he's coming back next year, I guarantee you that.
He is. He's like, I told him, well, Carlos, you know, you beat me last year. I beat you this year. We'll do best of three.
Well, we've been talking with Harvey Lewis. He recently won the Badwater 135 Ultra Marathon. Harvey, I have to be honest with you. This is one of my favorite interviews I've done in a long time, and it was really great to talk to you.
Thank you so much. Such an honor. And hello to everyone in Columbus. I know, loving the running community there. Looking forward to coming up to the Columbus Marathon. I'll be up there.
So Thomas and I meant to weigh in on this last week, but there was the big news of the OSU marching band scandal. Ray Rice, a running back for the NFL's Baltimore Ravens, was suspended 2 games for allegedly knocking out his fiancée at the time, whom he's married to now, suspended 2 games for knocking her out at a bar earlier this year. There was even surveillance video that surfaced in February of Rice dragging that woman out of an elevator while she was unconscious. It was a big scandal. It was a big deal in the NFL, and Rice suspended 2 games. And I think Thomas and I are both with NPR commentator Frank DeFord and the overwhelming majority of the media in saying that this 2-game suspension is really just a joke.
It really is. Two games for domestic violence, for quite frankly something that should warrant jail time. He's going through a program that's going to avoid going to a trial and ultimately avoid jail time. The NFL had a chance here to put a strong message out there against domestic violence, and I honestly think it failed.
That's right. And Deadspin, my favorite website, wrote up a big article about how they've told NFL fans who are females that they'd really just mean less, that this is really slightly dehumanizing, that this cheapens NFL female fans. And it really does. When you look at the things the NFL has tried to do to quell bad behavior among players, and then 2 games for this. It really does boggle the mind when I say it out loud. I'm still in disbelief. 2 games for knocking out a woman in a bar.
2 games in the NFL is worse than a slap on the wrist. 2 games in college, because those 2 games in college are normally against nobody teams. But in NFL, it's a little bit bigger deal than a 2-game suspension. But it's still 2 out of 16 plus playoff.
You and
potential.
I would be looking for a job 2 minutes after this happened,
yes,
if you and I were involved in this. And we do have a little list of players here who are suspended a lot longer. Josh Gordon facing an entire season at this point for smoking marijuana. Justin Blackmon, same deal. Terrell Pryor, 5 games for things he did in college.
Yeah, for selling his memorabilia for tattoos in college. He was given 5 games by the NFL. The NFL says that smoking marijuana is an entire year, so 8 times worse than knocking your wife out.
The NFL says that smoking some pot is worse than beating up your wife.
Eight times worse.
It was his fiance at the time. Okay. They're married now. Michael Vick suspended 2 games for dog fighting.
Oh, and then he went to jail. And
there were some pretty heinous things involved with that. Ben Roethlisberger suspended 4 games after some sordid accusations at a bar. Mm-hmm. No criminal charges filed against him. Criminal charges were dropped. There was no jail diversion program involved with that. The charges went away.
Yeah, he was suspended solely on conduct detrimental to the league. He was just in a bad place and put himself in a bad situation. He got 6 games, later reduced to 4 after he appealed. Just the precedent the NFL has set here with the 2 games for Ray Rice. I'm not saying the man should be kicked out of the league, but a 1-year suspension.
I'll say
is,
that. Why shouldn't he be kicked out of the league? I mean, if I did this to my wife, I would never get a radio job again.
That's true.
Never. And so why is Ray Lewis above our Ray Lewis, Ray Rice? Why is Ray Rice better than me in that regard? Maybe I'm exaggerating a little bit, but I have zero sympathy. I mean, Plaxico Burress suspended 4 games for shooting himself accidentally.
He accidentally shot himself at a club. He shouldn't have had a gun in New York and shouldn't have had it at the club. So he was suspended for the charges that followed. But he accidentally shot himself at a club and he got suspended for 4 games.
It's really just shameful for the NFL. It's a giant blemish on the shield of the NFL that they try to tout. And you've got Roger Goodell, who's really crafted this position of a moral authority, who's really gone so far out of his way to suspend players for these seemingly harmless things like smoking a little marijuana. And then a guy knocks his wife out, knocks his fiance out, and doesn't dispute the charges. He doesn't dispute anything prosecutors say. He gets 2 games.
Unreal.
And that will do it for this week's edition of After the Score from WOSU Public Media. You can always listen to the show using the WOSU Public Media mobile app, and you can find it on iTunes.
And follow the show on Twitter @AfterTheScore. Until next week, I'm Thomas Bradley.
And I'm Steve Brown.